public hearing on House Bill 5019, which is the Oregon Department of Education. I'm going to turn it over to the Superintendent Susan Castillo. And I understand we have Nancy Latini and Sue Michael Ashton and Madam Superintendent, just turn it over to you.
All right, thank you, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. For the record, Susan Castillo, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. We are continuing to tell our story about the work of the Oregon Department of Education. And so Dr. Nancy Latini, Assistant Superintendent from the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, will pick up today's presentation.
Mr. Chair, if I could, you'll
call. Oh, and I'm going to... I'm going to turn it over to Darren Hill very quickly.
Just real quickly, I just wanted you to know that there are two handouts in front of you. One of them is entitled Testimony Before the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and it's what Dr. Latino will be speaking from. It's a supplement, so we're still going to go through the slides that were in your original binder, but this is a supplement to that. The other one is from Dr. Moore, who it's basically to answer the questions that he had or that were given to him last Thursday, so this is his response back to those. So that's what this other handout is.
Great. Thank you very much. Dr. Latini, welcome.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Our office is charged with three very major tasks that are embedded in our mission statement. Those are that we're charged with assuring that students pre-K through post-secondary get services that they need, or if they don't get the services, that we create some way that they do get the services. And these would be for students with unique learning needs, whether they're instructional needs, socioeconomic needs, health needs, ethnicity, or language. The office also is charged with the development of strategies to address the unique learning differences for students through the dissemination of information and training to districts. And finally, we're charged with monitoring program and district compliance and performance related to federal and state law. The next slide shows our units within our department and in our office, and you can see there are many of them. The majority of our office, as you can see, also relates to special education. And the next slide, again, just repeats what our expectations for our office are. First, access to general education curriculum, assuring that we have accommodations and support services for students with unique needs, and to monitor, manage, and implement programs and services in response to state and federal law. The next two slides show our office and the programs and services within our office. I'll talk later about many of these early childhood programs, the school age programs, and then some of the other programs that are in our office. And I'll share with you how that relates to supporting districts and students. To talk a little bit about the budget drivers in our office, the ones that have major impact for us. The first one is the continuing caseload growth in special education. As of December 1 of 2006, 80,314 birth to 21 students were reported as receiving special education services. The growth in special education can be attributed to many things: better diagnosis, medical advances that keep children alive today that were not living years ago, breakthrough technology that assists in having students be more proficient in school than they ever had before. This growth is being seen across the country, but nonetheless there are costs involved. And the federal government and the federal funds have not kept up with the cost of supporting these students. The second budget driver would be something called the increase in the number of students with high-cost disabilities. This also impacts our operation. These students require something more than even the average special education student. It could be a special placement, it could be special transportation, it could be specialized supports or equipment, or some other kind of system that drives the cost. We have a high-cost disability fund that the Oregon Legislature created last session, and this has made a big difference to the districts that have these students enrolled. And this high-cost disability, just for you to know, is for school districts that spend over $30,000 in expenses to serve these students. There's also an increase in the families in poverty that leads us to needing to serve more children, preschool children, so that these children can come to school better ready to learn to have some of the basic readiness skills that their more fortunate peers obtain at home or in other places. The governor's budget does include an increase in funds for serving these students, and it would be a huge effort for Oregon in helping to close the achievement gap. The federal requirement of maintenance of effort is another budget driver. The concept here is rather simple. It's that the general fund expenditures for special education must be at least the same amount each year as the preceding year. And this requirement has been in law for districts since the law passed in the mid-70s. And the department conducts audits annually to assure that the districts remain in compliance with this requirement. This maintenance of effort requirement then was transferred also to to state agencies when the law was reauthorized in 1997. Failure for the state to meet maintenance of effort results in the reduction of federal money that comes to the state, and of course that would affect the amount of federal funds that would go out to districts as well. There are a few other budget drivers that I thought you would be interested in. One is the ever-changing rules in Medicaid. The rules are changing rapidly as they try to contain costs. Districts almost are afraid to bill for Medicaid for fear they're going to be breaking a law that they can't keep up with the changes. And we're working hard with the Department of Human Services to try to streamline that and see what does it really mean and what is it that school districts can bill for. The additional data reporting requirements, IDEA, Special Education Federal Law, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, when it was reauthorized in 2004, almost tripled the data requirements that we have to report. And what that does is makes us look for different staff as we hire new staff. In the past years, we used to have people that were specialists in each of the disability areas. We moved to people that know special education and the law better and know program development, and now we're also making sure that these people have the skills of looking at data, helping districts analyze it, and helping them implement anything that needs to be changed. And the final...
Excuse me, Dr. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a question about special education. My wife is a former elementary school director of special education, and I want to know what, if any, steps the Oregon Department of Education has taken to ensure that the money the state allocates for special education is ultimately spent by the districts in those programs.
90% of the federal funds that come to the department are sent directly out to districts. We do have audits, and we have a variety of audits that are put into place to see that those funds are spent in special education. We do the audits around high-cost disability and are they spending your federal funds before they ask the state for more money. We do them on the 11% cap, and are they spending your federal funds before they ask for more money beyond the count of 11% child count, which I'll talk about later. And we also just do basic audits around the maintenance of effort, which really gets us down to where they're spending their money.
Okay.
The final budget driver is one that's actually a statewide budget driver, and that's the Children's Change Initiative. And this is one being driven by the Department of Human Services, and the theory is fine as far as wanting to have children closer to home and be in support services. Right now, as they're going through their process, it's unclear whether most of those students are going to be in schools, which drive the costs up for high-need kids with usually with some behavioral problems, or whether they're going to continue to have some kinds of more local treatment for those students. Our key performance measures are both student and system growth measures. Let's show you an example of that. For example, in the early childhood programs, we address access as our goal of 80% of the children eligible for services. But in addition to access to the programs, we also expected in performance measure number two, looking at their readiness skills. How well did we do in preschool programs to prepare students for kindergarten? Another example might be if you look at student achievement, which addresses a systems issue, which is to create options in special education for all students to have access to the statewide assessments. But in addition to that, and more important, is how are the children doing? How are these students doing? And that would be taking a look at the student achievement and measuring that. It's not only having the services available, but then looking at that performance measure and making a difference for these students and what are we doing for that. And a final one might be looking at closing the achievement gap. And it might mean that the department leads the way in helping districts with some systems change and how they serve students. And again, we're looking back at making sure then that the students have the instruction that works for them so that they would be performing better and helping to close the achievement gap for at least one subgroup. The operations of this office include several elements. And I'm going to share with you some of the accomplishments that we've realized. This slide, slide 9, shows you some of the overall tasks and expectations. I'm not going to talk to each one of these. And if you have questions, please stop me and ask me questions. What I'll do is go on to slide 10 and talk a little bit about some of the accomplishments that we've reached. As you can see there, we've been successful in distributing and accounting for a lot of money. $254.8 million of federal special education money, $142.6 million in general fund money. This is all flows through directly from the state to the districts for their financial purposes. Along with those flow-through funds, though, we also do something called capacity building, and we use 8% of our funds to go to districts for things to help them look at best practices, developing systems, and making sure that they work for themselves. You can see we had some compliance training on compliance with the new law. There had to be a lot of training going on. We gave districts some funds so that they could allow for substitute teachers, they could allow for trainings themselves, could hold parent information sessions. And we also did some training on traumatic brain injury, and again, an identified need within the state. Some of the most interesting work that we do actually comes in local capacity building, because you're able to take some theory and take a look at it and help districts and develop some systems that work for themselves. And you can see on slide 11, there are way too many of these that I'm not going to talk to all of them, but you can see what some of the activities are that we did. Many of these activities also assist in looking at performance measures. For example, looking at the activities that we do around dropout, safe schools, closing the achievement gap, also looking at materials and equipment, the two acronyms there, statewide system so that students can get the equipment that they need, or the materials, whether it's Braille or whether it's some other kinds of checks that they need in order to stay in school and succeed, that we do. Three of the capacity building grants are three-year initiatives that we started and are very excited about. I'm going to talk just very briefly about all three of them. And in your supplemental handouts, A, B, and C, give you a one-page summary of what those are, and on the back side of them are the school districts that are identified as working right now on these projects, so you can see if you have districts in your area that are involved. Response to intervention is a process of a new way of identifying students with learning disabilities. And the old age way of identifying students with learning disabilities is to give them a psychological test, measure their ability, and measure their performance. And if there's a big spread, you call them learning disabled. Response to intervention takes a look at actually intervening with the student, having the teacher try some strategies, sitting down with the team and seeing if it works. If it doesn't work, not doing more of the same, but doing something different, and having those variety of strategies at the school level. And that way, after attempts at a couple or three, depending on where the student is, a referral could be made to special education. This is a huge difference, but it also takes some training. Tegu Tualatin School District has been doing this for almost 10 years. They got a grant, and they've almost perfected it to a degree, and are starting now to look at some of the secondary schools in their district. But they also have a contract with us now to help us to spread this statewide. And we, quite frankly, could not keep up with the requests from districts on learning how to do this in a formalized way. It's a lot of data collection, a lot of conversations among the school people about how successful a strategy is. And people are wanting that, and they want to look at this. It doesn't just help kids with disabilities. It helps all kids as far as strategies if they're lagging behind for some reason. We did write a federal grant that we got for a five-year grant for $4.9 million that will help us to spread this statewide, we hope. And along with that, another initiative, the second one, Positive Behavior Supports. These have been around Oregon and Oregon schools for a long, long time. And what the department is trying to do is to do more of a district-wide positive behavior support system so we can ensure more sustainability. When a single school does it, it's often dependent on a principal or someone in the school interested, and if that person leaves, it could fall apart. And what positive behavior supports is all about is looking at the behaviors in a school. And the nice thing about this is the teachers and administrators decide what's important and what's acceptable at our school, And how do we then respond to those people who fall outside of those? So, you know, for some kids, just a hello, you're doing a great job, is fine. For other kids, they're going to need direct instruction of some sort about how to behave in school. And then there are kids who might need special ed interventions, and you might need kids that also go to placements. But it sort of reads out in a formalized way, and teachers are really responding well to that, and they're very interested. And Lindbett and Lincoln ESD has been doing this for a long time in helping schools, and right now they're helping us to put this also on a statewide basis. Both of these, of course, are if you look at them, would be the what we were hoping would be closing the achievement gap, student achievement, and all sorts of positive things for the right kids and the right services. The other initiative I just wanted to share with you, because I know you have an interest in autism, is the Autism Model Classrooms. And this has been pretty exciting for us. We have, a contract with Portland State University, and they've been developing sites across the state. We have about 40 of them right now in the state. And again, I think in C of your handouts, you'll see the school districts that have been involved. These sites are preschool, elementary, middle school, high school, and they're actually a model site within that area, and some children are placed there that need that kind of special class placement, but it also serves as a training mechanism for people to come and observe, but also for that teacher who's specially trained to train other people. And the other part that's even more exciting that we're building right now is the issues around parent involvement. So when a parent has a conference and they don't know what to do with their child with autism around a certain issue, there are packages you can give a parent and say, try these techniques, give me a call. And so we're still building on that. The rural areas in particular are very successful, and it's very meaningful because in the past, parents would have to come to the metro area to first find the trained teachers, to find the services. And at this point, no matter where you live in Oregon, by the time we've gotten a couple more years behind us, it'll be anywhere you live in Oregon, you should be able to access these kinds of services and specialties. The next slide is on maintenance of effort, and we talked a little bit about that already, so I won't talk about it anymore, except that we're really happy that we only have three districts left that we're trying to get into compliance with this regulation. When we started the slides, we had 25 districts still to go. We spent a lot of time with them, helping them to look at how they're coding their funds. Oftentimes, they're coding them wrong, or they don't quite understand what a real special education service might be and for what students, so we go down to the details with them. When we did the slides, we had five districts that were still remaining that we had to work with, and as of last Friday, we're down to three, so we're feeling pretty good about helping districts meet that requirement. We do a lot of intensive work around accountability and compliance. With the many contracts that we have for serving students and the contracts we have for program development, it takes a lot of detailed work to make sure that those funds are spent as they're intended to be spent and that we get the deliverables before we send money back out to the districts. The third to the last on that list, along with the fiscal monitoring, there's a very large portion of our time that's spent on compliance review for the federal special education bond requirements. Right now, we've got our reviews down to a web-based compliance monitoring system, and it saved a lot on staff travel time and on staff time away from the office. It's pretty amazing to walk around our office, and you can watch the staff on the phone with their computer, with the districts, all their information in front of them, and then showing the district how to go to other sites that are like them and compare results, and then maybe moving to another site to look at what kinds of improvements might you want to do. And so it saves a lot of time. We also do verification visits, however, when things are not looking like they should look. I think, as you know, with the children and anybody else and with school districts, we've learned this, they're harder on themselves than we might be if we were out there. But also we have the good communication and conversation with them. Superintendents have called this a far friendlier version of the old five-member ODE team going out to their school district for a week. And they also feel that they own it a lot more because they're creating the data, they're looking at the data, and they're telling us what the data looks like and what they think it says, as opposed to the department bringing them the data and saying, here's your problem, and they don't have any ownership. So we're feeling pretty good about what we're doing there at this time. The second to the last one on slide 13, for the first time, the reauthorization of the federal special education law is requiring that we report the performance of school districts on a set of indicators to the public. And actually, these went out in the form of a report card just a few days ago. In your package under E, you will have samples of those report cards, and I tried to get them for most of your school districts so that you'd have some interest in those. We also have a copy of the indicators. This is the first year we had to do it. There are very few indicators that we had the data that's nationwide. We had data on that all states could report on. But you'll find the list there of additional data points that we will have to report on in the following year. And that's under Section E. In addition to that, the state also has to has an obligation to submit a state plan with a set of indicators and performance measures. And it's very it's not very surprising, but it was surprising, that a lot of the performance measures they're asking us to report on are the same ones that we've been talking about for the last few days. So here's a couple of examples. We have to report on the graduation rates and the dropout rates for students compared to students with disabilities compared to students without disabilities. We have to compare and take a look at participation rates and performance rates for students with disabilities and compare them and also report on whether or not adequate yearly progress is met for this subgroup. One of the newer ones that we started that we have to also report on is the level of parent satisfaction with involvement in the process. And we're doing this with a national survey that's been created, and we do a random selection of parents across the state, and we're just starting to look at that data that's come in at this point. Related to accountability also is the December 1 child count. And just so that we talked about it as a budget driver, and I want you to know that this child count is what drives the funds that the department gets that we send out to districts. And handout F has a couple of examples of some of the information on the December 1, 2006 child count, some of the numbers of our and by disability and also just in overall ratings. For children to get on this list, students to get on this list, they have to have three things. They have to have a current individual education plan, they have to have a current assessment that says they are eligible for special education, and they have to be actively enrolled in the school on December 1. They can't be on a drop list of any sort. Going to move on to the programs in early childhood. Well, programs in early childhood include the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, the Early Intervention Early Childhood Special Education Program, and two small federal programs called Even Start and Teen Parents. We're also leading the charge on some of the kindergarten enhancements that are one of the department's priorities. Slide 14 shows the Oregon Pre-K program, and what it is it's really aligned to the federal Head Start program. So two separate pots of money, but we align the programs so that the standards are the same, and the funds in a way are blended at those sites. So our most needy, our poorest and our neediest families of 3 and 4 year olds go to these programs. They're not labeled as whether they're Head Start or OPK. The funding takes care of that without us having to deal with it at the program level. This is an income-based program. They have to meet a certain 100% of the poverty rate. Communities can also determine some additional criteria if they need to set some kind of standard, and whether it's disability or mental health or alcohol and drug problems in their families, they can set those as criteria. But the first one has to be the income that needs to be met. Each county in Oregon has a program. These are run by school districts, ESDs, private nonprofit, community-based, post-secondary programs. So a variety of people run these programs for us. The governor's budget has a policy option package for a $39 million increase to expand their program to 80% of the eligible children. We'll be expanding it by about 20%. Performance measures that we would look at, of course, would be the access, the 80%, and we'd also, again, be looking at that readiness performance measure. The next slide shows
the chart. Excuse me, Dr. Lutini. Dr. Senator Devlin has a question.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the expansion from 60 to 80%, what activities does the Department of Education plan on pursuing should that be funded, and how long would it actually realistically take you to get to that level of usage, in a sense? It's not going to happen overnight that you're going to go from 60 to 80%.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, the staff has already talked to people with current programs to see what it would mean for them, and most of the people seem to be ready. If you do it in a layering, it would definitely take the 2 years, and we would probably start late with the first group of kids because we would want to make sure that all the criteria were in place as far as what was needed.
Okay. Two questions, actually. Have facilities issues been brought up as a portion of that discussion? Have there been school districts that identified that they might have inadequate facilities to be able to get to that level?
Chair Glazio, Senator Devlin, I'm not aware of anybody saying they possibly can't be doing these. And one of the reasons is they can also go to other community sites, which is a little bit more flexibility than the public school sites and spaces.
Okay. Final.
Mm-hmm.
80% has been expressed as covering all eligible children, because there's an assumption there that the last 20%, for one reason or another, would not actually seek or enrolling their children in the program. Do you think with a significant outreach effort that 80% figure could be moved higher?
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, I would always hope so. People tell me that that's sort of the running rate nationally, but I don't know. It's a hard one to talk about, other than what people tell me that they've learned and they've read about and I've read about. Sort of leave it like that. But I would always hope for that, especially not knowing which ones those 20% might be.
Thank you.
The chart on slide 16 shows the potential growth with that 20% increase of children that we would serve. Next early childhood program we'll talk about a little bit is the early intervention, early childhood special education program. This program, it serves children birth to school age, which is usually 5 years old, and these children are, of course, disabled. There's specially designed instruction to provide these children and their families school readiness skills, but in addition to that, this program works with families to help them understand their child's disability and the potential impact that disability might have on education when they reach school age. At this time, they're also able to take a look at what accommodations a child might need when they enter school, so that we don't have the delays once they're there about what works and what doesn't work. There is no waiting list allowed in these programs. There is no income level required. All the child needs is to have an identified disability, and we need to serve them. We do this through contracts with 9 contracts with ESDs on a statewide basis. As you can see on the slide on slide 18, over the past few years, this program has seen a rise in numbers of students. And there was a budget note related to this, and I believe we may be talking about that at tomorrow at a later time. There isn't a slide on this, but I do want to share this with you. One of the exciting things that happened in early childhood is that we did create a statewide assessment for these children. It's a rating list, an observation, it's not a paper pencil test. And along with that assessment, we've also assigned students a secure student identifier number. So for the first time, Oregon's going to be able to monitor and follow the progress of students that have been in programs that have been funded by the department in preschool and follow them into school-age programs as long as they stay in Oregon. So I'm fairly excited about that. We're just starting to look at our first baseline data, and we'll be getting more information on that. School-age programs that we are responsible for providing education to are for students that are in unique situations, whether it's certain special education programs, corrections, mental health services, and we're obligated to provide the services. In handout G of the supplement that I just gave you are a list of these programs and the contractors again, so that you can see if your areas have some of these programs. The regional programs are a grant and aid program that was created by the Oregon legislature to be a cost-effective means for certain special education services for children birth to 21. And these are the services we call low-incidence, high-need program students. They could be vision-impaired, they could be hearing-impaired, they could be deaf-blind, could be severe orthopedically impaired, autistic, and we added traumatic brain injury at the last session to that list of people. These services are provided through 8 regional sites within across the state. Well, these services, these children have some unique and high needs services. They don't always fit around in the same geographic areas. So you might have a deaf child or a blind child in remote areas someplace, and they do need some services. The regional services provide for that hiring on the capacity level. Otherwise, the district would be searching for a feeding specialist or an OT for 2 hours a week, and which would be almost impossible for them to do. So that is the theory behind the regional programs, is to have that strength in numbers for these types of children that aren't very high in number, but have some unique needs that specially trained people aren't just everywhere across the state. Long-term care and treatment programs are for students placed in residential or day treatment programs by the Department of Human Services or the Oregon.
Excuse me, Senator Morse. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me for interrupting. Looking at slide 19, the number of children that are served in this biennium versus forecast for the 07-09. And then looking at the change from 2003 through 2006, what are the principal drivers for that increase?
The principal driver in our expectation was students with autism. The second driver is that we're potentially planning for now is the increase in capacity at Dornbecker Children's Hospital for students in the hospital programs, which are regional and hospital, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But most of that is the increase in students with autism.
Thank you.
Follow up with that, Mr. Chair.
Along the same lines, I noticed that those numbers as well. When you look at states that surround Oregon and the services that they provide to the similar demographic, does Oregon provide increased benefits, on par benefits, or decreased benefits as it relates to your states that surround us? Are we attracting folks to come to Oregon to take advantage of this program, or are we on par? Talk a little bit about that, if you might.
Chair Galizio, Senator Starr, I believe in Oregon, like most states, provides basics. I don't think that we have excessive amounts of services. I don't hear people moving here for these services. Any special education services, I don't hear people moving here for.
So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, you would say that we are on par with what other states provide in similar demographic, child demographic?
Chair Galizio, Senator Starr, I believe so. I mean, we're obligated to provide the services, and I believe we provide what's needed, but not what's nice and needed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The long-term care and treatment programs, as I just said, again, under law, we're responsible for the education costs, and those costs are delivered through ESDs and school districts where these programs are located. The hospital education programs are really the programs that are for the 5 statewide hospitals, and these are for children who have acute long-term medical needs, cancer, severe burns, head injuries, and also for those who are hospitalized for serious mental health conditions. And again, these are contracts with our regional staff as well. The youth corrections educational program and the juvenile detention education programs are also programs that we're required to provide education services for. The youth corrections education program serves students 12 to 25 who are incarcerated in 10 of the Oregon Youth Authority correctional facilities. And these are contracts, again, with 8 school districts or ESDs, and again, they're on the list that you have under your handout. There's also a budget note related to this program, and I think we'll be talking about tomorrow. The juvenile detention program, then, is, of course, for the students who are in the 15 county detention centers, and most of these are short-term placements, but nonetheless, we're required to ensure that education is there for them while they're there. Community schools, this is a policy option package that was in the governor's budget, and it's in a cooperative venture with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, who's also granted funds in this policy option package in the governor's budget. The intent here is to create community services sites, usually at a school, that would provide a variety of services in the community, and then hopes for us, as far as education is concerned, is to increase that engagement of students in school efforts, whether it's extended learning opportunities, whether it's providing access to some of the community services that they need, and coordinating some of the family needs. And of course, the performance measures we would look at if this policy option package stays in our programs would be number 11, the suspension, expulsion, truancy, and of course, number 3, student achievement. The next set of slides has to do with our state schools, the Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf. And again, both of these programs serve a set of students with very unique needs, and they've been operated by the department under statutory authority. Both have been established since the 1800s. On a continuum of services that are mandated by the federal government, these programs should represent those students who have been unsuccessful at getting the services that they need in their local district and then be moved on to a more restrictive type placement like the state schools. You can see Oregon School for the Blind on slide 26 and 27 serving 29 students. All but two are residential students, and all the students go home for the weekend. The Oregon School for the Deaf, you'll see slides 28 and 29, their mission statement. School for the Deaf serves about 110 students. 48 of them are residential. The rest of them go home every evening, and there are no weekend programs at this point. You'll also see that OSD has earned some accreditations for their program.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. May Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These programs for students with solely sensory problems, or do they also have other? Well, actually, I see you have multiple disabled. Mm-hmm. Could you take just another second and describe those multiple disabilities?
In the School for the Blind, Chair DeLizio, Representative Barnhart, in the School for the Blind, many of the multiple disabilities are physical, and some of them are low-functioning cognitive issues. The School for the Deaf, some of the difficulties are behavioral. Second language students, they have a number of students right now that are second language and deaf, which poses an interesting instructional program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For both the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, obviously there are students with similar conditions being mainstreamed in the public schools. Do you ever decide that a student should be, they're at a level that they should be sent back to basically be mainstreamed in their own public school?
Chair DeLizio, Senator Devlin, by law, the individual education team, the IEP team at the school district and the parent make the placement decisions. We can't override those decisions. A parent could say, I don't want my child here, I want my child there. But we cannot override those decisions.
I can tell if there's going to be a follow-up.
Mr. Chairman,
the suspense is killing me.
Have there been circumstances when school officials have questioned those placements?
Chair DeLizio, Senator Devlin, yes. And they would have a new IEP meeting. A district has every right to change a placement for a student.
Okay.
And a parent has every right to say, I want my child back. And tell you a story about when I was a special ed director, I had a student that was in a special class in Portland, and he kept saying, we're coming back. And all I could think of was, where am I going to get the interpreter? How am I going to do this? But I would say, okay. And every year we'd talk about it, and every year he'd feel he wanted to stay there. But if he did choose to come back, and if we felt that that was where the child needed to be, we would change that placement, even if Portland thought that was the best place.
Final, Mr. Yeah. But can the School for the Deaf or the School for the Blind initiate that second review?
Chair DeLizio and Senator Devlin, absolutely they can, yes.
Okay.
You'll notice that the numbers have gone down substantially in both of these programs and some of the documents that you have in your notebook. And some of that is that schools are more used to having these children in their schools, communities more used to them, and the regional programs offer the supports that parents feel comfortable not having their children go away for a week at a time.
Thank you.
There is a budget note around the School for the Deaf where our session we were directed to conduct a study, and that's in your package, and I believe we'll be talking about all the budget notes tomorrow. the improvement planning for our office, we certainly take a look at how can we do things better, but we have to ask other people how we can do things better. We can't sit around by ourselves and decide that. And how we do that is we do that through annual stakeholder meetings. We do it through a quarterly special education community advisory group. We also have a quarterly special education director advisory group with school people, and then other similar evaluations that are the usual kind. And what we know from what we hear from other people that we'll need to keep our eye on are some of the things that keep us in the concept of universal design, which means that our job should be to make sure that all kids are included in any venture or any new initiative that goes on at the state level, to make sure everybody's included at some way. So we know that with response to intervention and positive behavior supports, we need to continue and expand those. We know that the rural areas in particular are asking for more of the autism model classrooms. We are in the middle right now, in the middle of just the first part of the efficiency study for our special early childhood special education program, as well as our regional programs. Now, by June, we should have a report on that. We are also looking at knowing that we need to look more at the concept of ready schools and schools ready. We do a lot of work around preparing kids for school. We also want to do a lot of work, and we are starting to do a lot of work around having schools ready for all the kids that enter their doors. And actually, tomorrow, during the kindergarten summit, where we're going to roll out something that a lot of agencies across the state have helped us with as far as get ready schools. Can you say anything about the summit?
Yeah, we're having, about 400 people coming to the summit tomorrow. It's the first time that we've brought kindergarten teachers from around Oregon together to really focus on the quality of programs. And it's going to be a great discussion. We're bringing up a National Teacher of the Year this year who comes from back east. She's a kindergarten teacher. She's just wonderful. She's already in our state. And we'll be having a dinner in her honor tonight, and then tomorrow we'll be hearing from her as well. And she's very inspiring, a strong, strong supporter of early learning and helping children throughout those first few years of their education, from early on, preschool, kindergarten, full day kindergarten, and just has a wonderful story to tell about how she approaches her work and the success that she has at the kindergarten level to help children get a strong start in school. So it's going to be a good day tomorrow. It'll be a first, and we'll see how it goes.
And one last thing that's really not just in our office, but it's a department-wide and a statewide effort. Subsequent to House Bill 3184, or the ESD bill as some people call it, we took on as a department several tasks. First of all, we had two reports done, the Gibson report and the Annenberg report, both of which are in your packets. The Gibson report looked at the efficiencies and the redundancies in five different ESDs and came up with some recommendations. And the Annenberg report process was really a process we went through about how do we work together to get some of this work done. And what we have done since then is formed an education enterprise steering committee. It's made up of superintendents from districts, from ESDs, the department, and after we met a couple of times to talk about how are we going to create action plans around these reports and respond to them, we decided in our spirit of the pre-K-20, we added and invited the higher ed people to join us, and also a staff member from the governor's staff joined our committee. And at this point, where we are is the department has created some performance measures for the committee as a group, and you have that in Section 8. There's one page. It's still a draft form. But we started to put together how will we know that this committee is really responding to these reports and to what the intent in the legislation was. The interesting part of this was that one of the members of that committee asked if there was any way to look at those measures and match them to the measures that we're talking about for the kids in Oregon. And so you'll see some funny little PM things on the side, and that was my attempt. I found two so far, and I'm still working on those because we have to take those back to have the whole committee support, but at this point I am starting to look at that. We're also looking at templates for the ESD annual report so that there's a better way for everybody to look and compare different ESDs on different performance measures. And hopefully that'll make some difference for all of us in looking consistently at those programs. So thank you for listening to me. I'll be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lutina. I know Darren Hill, LFO analyst, had a question about the pre-K.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lutina, can you talk a little bit about what the federal poverty percentage does to the need for the OPK program? How it affects the 80% basically?
Right now, for a parent to be eligible with their children in a family of four, is to make $20,000 a year. The legislation at the federal level right now is wanting to take advantage of increasing that, and I don't know how this is going to affect us at this point, but right now when we're reading this, increasing that to more of the working poor families, which then would create an option of eligible student children being anybody who's like eligible for free and reduced lunch. That kind of gives you that the feel for an increased number of children that might be eligible. I don't know what that would do for our percentage at this point. So I'm not answering your question directly.
Well, I guess my point was we had talked a little bit about the poverty percentage has actually increased since the governor's budget. And do you want to talk a little bit about what that does to the, what the $39 million buys since the poverty rate has increased by
about percentage? It keeps buying less. Is that what you're asking me?
That's exactly
okay,
what
I'm asking. I don't like to hear that, but it's true. As the poverty level changes, those numbers change. And so it's really probably one of the most difficult things I've had to do since I've had this job is try to look at OPK and say, what does this mean? Because numbers change because poverty level changes. And at one point in time, when we looked every biennium at it, the numbers are always going up and down. We've gotten some advice that we probably ought to average it out over 5 years so that we get some kind of a feel of some sort for this. And we're just starting that conversation now. But in essence, as poverty rate rises, we get fewer kids that will be served.
And Darren, did you know what the percentage that you...
And Mr. Chair, we've had some discussions with the department, and it appears that the poverty percentage went up by approximately 1%. And what that does is essentially, if you run the same numbers based upon the governor's budget, that's about a 5% decrease in those being able to be served.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Can I get a clarification on that? When you say poverty rate increasing, are you saying that the federal government is increasing the amount of allowable income at a particular rate, or are they increasing, or are we actually getting a net increase at the current income levels of children in poverty?
Do you want to answer that, Dr. McKee?
In general, we've been getting more children in poverty. So
the percentage of folks in poverty increased by 1%.
Okay. But the federal government has not increased the poverty level in terms of income levels.
They haven't at this point.
Okay. But Dr. Zatine, you were talking about pending legislation that was distinct from what we were just discussing, which would...
Chair DeWizio, that would happen. If that legislation did go through, it would change the poverty level and more people would be eligible for the program in addition to our poverty rate going up.
Okay. I hate to beat this one, but I'm still am not certain that I understand the point that's been made. You're looking at both things happening, perhaps. Both we have more people making less money, and the definition of poverty may change to increase the amount of money you can make and still be considered in poverty. Is that right?
Chair Galizia, Representative Barnhart, that's what I believe right now the conversation is.
Okay, and if I could follow that up then. And then I thought you said after that means fewer children would be eligible. And I would have thought it the other way around, that in fact more children would be eligible. So did I misunderstand that somehow?
I think possibly what I meant to say was that more children would be eligible, not less children would be eligible, but we'd be serving less as far as the percentage because we have
a smaller percentage of the larger number.
Right.
Thank you. Now I understand.
So, and I think, in other words, the governor's recommended budget of $39 million for pre-K. So that $39 million would only cover what, 75% of the eligible children, 80% that was...
Because his number is based on a percentage, and as the gross numbers change, the number of kids that they will actually cover doesn't change, but the percentage does.
Yeah. That's why in the revenue committee you have to get us more money.
Yes.
That's your job.
Mr. Chair, we're working at that.
I'm making Senator Starr, who's getting really angry. Senator Devlin.
Well, if you... could you give us a number, because I'd just be curious in terms of, we actually know that in this number, if you were to increase originally at our level to about 80%, I think you go to about 24,000 children being covered. You probably have the numbers for the number of kindergarten and first grade students that are on free and reduced lunches. My expectation is that that would significantly, if you went to that standard, it would significantly increase, not mildly increase, but significantly increase the number of children that would be eligible for this pre-K program. Could you get those numbers for us?
Representative Barnard.
Well, and a follow-up on that. This is really not a numbers question. Should we be covering that larger number of people in order to accomplish our educational goals?
And Chair Galizio, Representative Barnhart, my answer would be yes. Because we know if we help those children get a strong start, they will do well. You know, they stand a better chance of doing well in school, and that we get a great return for that investment.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Great.
Thank you very much, Dr. Latini.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, I'd like to now invite Doug Costi, the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Assessment and Information Services, to continue our presentation. He has lots of information about data and technology in education and is prepared to tell that story.
Thank you, Superintendent Castillo. Chair Galizio, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Assessment and Information Services. Today I'd like to address the following points in my presentation. I'd like to give you a brief description of my office, the mission, goals, and objectives, give you an idea of some of the major budget drivers impacting the enterprise of education with respect to assessment and information services, and I'd like to give a glimpse in terms of how Oregon compares to other states and what the current state of our assessment and data systems is, and I'm going to give you a little overview of the policy option package. My colleagues gave me some guidance on how to do this presentation to bring it to a level that we can all comprehend, that everybody can understand, because sometimes I talk in a different language. So I'm interjecting a story about Joey, oh, speaking of which, I have an extra handout to hand out to folks.
Thought he was
going to
bring out Joey.
I know. There he is.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know sometimes how IT people speak a different language, so that's what he's referring to today, and he's trying to tell his story in a more clear, understandable way.
I'm trying to give you a picture of what happens to a student as a student progresses through education from pre-K through the university system, so you can kind of get a flavor of what all of these data systems mean and how the assessment picture looks. So with that, as you can see from my mission statement, we're all about quality information. You heard from Dr. Latini and Dr. Knorr about how important data are to their organizations and how they're using those data. What I'd like to point to is, you know, from a national perspective, there are tons of articles. I believe there's an article in EdWeek, from EdWeek in your handout, or on the U.S. Chamber report. Across the nation, schools are being rewarded for making adequate yearly progress simply because they have a group of students that are particularly bright and articulate. On the other hand, in high poverty schools, kids are making tremendous effort, making tremendous growth, and however, they're not hitting the status or the acceptable benchmark. Even though they're on a trajectory to make that at some point in the future, those schools and districts aren't getting credit for that growth for those individual kids. There are articles, innumerable articles on data errors that are being caused within Oregon, across the nation. Late reports of data coming in from assessment systems, errors because of the volume of data coming in and trying to be crunched through these accountability systems. These types of situations create very demoralizing situations for staff within departments of education at regional service districts, schools, and districts. And hopefully my presentation today will kind of give you an idea of what we can do to improve the situation for Oregon. This is a picture of my office, the structure, and how my office is organized. I have about 75 staff in my area that cover the functions of data collection, analysis, reporting, as well as developing and administering the statewide assessments. These functions are tightly coupled within my office and within the rest of the agency. I have a very talented group of folks that are working for me in these functions, and I'm very proud of the work that they do. Relative to the goals and objectives of this office, I would like to say that we're doing all of these things very well, but I must admit there are some improvements that need to be made. Thanks to the thoughtful investment by the last legislature to the Kids Initiative, we're making headway. Thanks to the 1997 investment into the Database Initiative Project, it's created a strong foundation for us to move our data systems forward. We do have, of course, quite a bit of work to do to increase the data analysis, analytical, and research capacity of our organization. With your consideration and approval of the policy option package, the pre-K-12 integrated data system, assessment literacy, longitudinal growth, cross-office data management policy option packages, we can continue to build upon these foundations. My office spends about $24 million per biennium on data collection and reporting and assessment systems. Of that, a little over $11.5 million, which is less than the total, comes from the federal government for assessment purposes. One of the articles I referred to earlier indicated that based on what we look like, what Oregon looks like in comparison to other states, specifically the EdLeak and U.S. Chamber reports, Oregon needs to continue the work we started this year with staff collections. For the first time, we are assigning individual staff IDs to every certificated and non-certificated staff in the state. We need to better develop policies and strategies for linking student and staff data. We need to improve our data security policy and use privacy and use policies. And what we believe is that the kids work and the cross-office policy option packages will support this new work. EdWeek further indicated that Oregon, with respect to other states, has significant work to do in providing educators with access to school performance and analytical tools, different types of student-level data through a centralized portal, and resources to assist in the analysis and use of data. We believe our POPs will handle these needs.
Excuse me, Mr. Costi. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do school districts keep their own records, same data that's submitted to you? Do they keep that data as well?
Chair Galizio, Senator Morse, yes, they actually keep even more granular level of data. They have more data than we require for them to submit to us.
So the benefit to the district of having a centralized warehouse is what?
Chair Galizio, Senator Morse, the benefit to the district is it's particularly beneficial to students because we don't have, and I'll talk about this later on when we talk about Joey and the disconnect between the student information systems and the warehouses that are beginning to emerge. But what we lack is a consistent set of data standards about student-level data. KIDS is developing those standards, but the data are primarily stored in what's referred to as student information systems. These are the transactional systems that register individual students as they come into the system and move through the system. Demographic data, program data, which programs those children are enrolled in or have been enrolled in, their performance data, how they do in their courses, their GPAs within high schools and elementary schools, and how they're doing on the state assessment systems.
Just as a follow-up, this is more of a comment, I think, than a question. I sometimes wonder if our data collection is more for our benefit than it is for the students' benefit.
Chair Galizio, Senator Morris, point well taken. In addition to the, I'm back on the previous slide. In addition to the data work, our Oregon assessments are unique. They're web-based and they're adaptive. Oregon teachers write the items and score the writing reports, the writing assessments. The Oregon TESA system allows up to 3 opportunities over a 9-month window. We can proudly say we're the only state that allows that large of a window and that many opportunities for kids to test in an accountability framework. The adaptive engine requires fewer test questions, which means a child doesn't have to be in front of the computer or in front of a piece of paper taking assessments as long as they would in other states. And what we truly believe is the assessment literacy and longitudinal growth POPs, along with the longitudinal data systems grant that you approved earlier last week, will go a long way to cover some of these issues. Accomplishments and improvements for my office. We publish over 150 test forms, different test forms in math, reading, writing, in grades 3 through 8 and 10. And we do that in different languages. We do that in English, Spanish, and Russian. We also produce an English language proficiency assessment, the extended assessments that Dr. Latini was referring to. What those multiple formats do is generate about 1.5 million assessments, individual assessments each year. And we administer those assessments throughout 1,200 school districts and 200 districts across the state. This year, in order to comply with United States Department of Education requirements, we went through a total series of studies, technical adequacy studies, to ensure that we have a valid, reliable, and defensible system of standards and assessments. With respect to the technology or the information services arm of my office, this slide's here to demonstrate what we've done to consolidate and streamline. I might also add that between IT and assessment, we attend monthly advisory committees with the field to get us up to date on what their needs are. They provide advice to us on data collections, on administration of assessments, etc. So we are connected real time with all of our stakeholders in the field. Finally, with respect to accomplishments and quality improvements, I'm proud to say that one of our efficiency gains was about $300,000 a year. We used to print and distribute a paper-based school and class report to all of the schools and districts in the state. This was a $300,000 logistical process. It took months to get the paper and pencil to the classroom and in the hands of the instructors. By the time it got there, the kids were already into the next grade level. What we did to remediate that was to take our tech team and develop web-based reporting, a secure web-based reporting mechanism, so that schools and districts would have access to these data on a real-time basis and forego the need to go through the logistical process. We also developed an innovative contract with three lead ESDs. We used to negotiate contracts with 12 ESDs to provide help desk and support for the administration of our assessments. We managed to move that from 12 to 3 and moved all of the scoring contracts for our writing assessments out to these ESDs and reduced our temporary employees by 1,200. Real briefly on this slide, I want to point out the use of the term regional warehouse here. What I'm referring to is not Costco. What I'm referring to is a data warehouse. And there are about six of them in the development stages currently. And some are getting real close to being operational, some are operational, and some will probably be operational next biennium. But it's important to note that those regional data warehouses are starting to pop up, because those are the ways that kids' data become more standardized and more useful. Getting the information out of what's referred to as a student information system is a challenge, and it's a little bit kludgy for teachers and administrators to get access to that kind of information. The warehouse makes it more accessible and more meaningful for policymakers. How did we get here? Well, briefly, thanks to the funding of the DVI, that set us up for secure student identifier. Without the database initiative, we wouldn't have had the web-based technical infrastructure to collect data. That is how we got to a point where, in about 2001, we started assigning unique student identifiers to every child in the state. Now we have data on all of those kids over that period of time. The requirements of No Child Left Behind are forcing states to collect and track student and staff level data. It is a fact of life. These huge new requirements and our available resources are not adequate to maintain this level of accountability. Who should have access to what data? Well, students and parents obviously need access to data. Teachers and administrators need access to the data. The state Department of Education needs access. We need to write reports for the feds, for the new folks, and for policymakers in general. I'm going to take you through the story of Joey now and try to put this all in context and see if we can get this to make sense.
Okay, before we get to Joey, Representative Barnhart has a question.
There's one group missing. And that's the general public.
Mm-hmm.
If we do a good job of reporting to the general public of what our successes and failures are, we are much more likely to get the kind of support that we need in order to do a good job of both of providing educational services and of having adequate resources to pay for them. And I think it's telling that that's missing from your slide. It's something we have to pay more attention to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, before we get into I'd like to just ask a question. And I don't know how much of it is a question. It's a little bit of editorializing. Do you know, we talk a lot about the attrition rate of teachers in K through 12, in the first 5 years we lose about, 40% of teachers. And I wonder how, I don't know if that's the last 5 years, the last 7 years, and how does that compare to previous periods? Because I'm at the community college level, and we have a pretty generous degree of control over what happens in the classroom and freedom, and
the idea is that you're a professional and that you've mastered a subject and you therefore have learned a bit about teaching and getting what you want. I'm just reading all of this and going through it. You've got the federal government saying you need to meet these kind of standards and do all this testing, and then it filters down to the state level, and then the teachers in the classroom are sort of jumping through these hoops. And so I just can't imagine wanting to teach and doing that. And it seems like, I guess it almost goes back to Senator Morris's question, is sort of, to what end is all of this? Is this the best thing that we should be doing, I guess is my question.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, just for your reference, in your state report card on page 70, there is a graph that shows you the trend of teachers leaving, and there's a list on the right-hand side of that graph about reasons why teachers, the reasons they give for leaving, and the trend, why teachers quit, and the trend is, shows you from 1994 to 2006. And on that page, I guess what I would say is that yes, there are many, many challenges for our teachers, and especially as we went through this last recession, it has been incredibly challenging for our teachers, and with the growing accountability, as you said, you know, from the state and the federal government. But the other thing we know is that in our work on leadership and developing strong leaders in our school, we know that when you have a strong leader in the school, it makes a huge difference on what happens to those teachers in terms of their ability to be more successful in school, to be able to feel to create a climate that is more supportive of teachers, and that really creates a more successful climate for teachers and really contributes to them continuing to stay in the profession and seeing that they have a very, very strong support and a leader who knows how to help teachers be able to work together and support one another to help children be more successful. So a lot of the work that we have been doing around leadership is very, very much related to how we create these more positive environments for our teachers to be successful and to want to continue to stay in the profession and feel supported. So that is one of the key areas that we know we need to continue to work on and make more progress on in our state. And thanks, I think we mentioned earlier that thanks to a grant with the Wallace Foundation, we have been able to work with a number of districts in the state, and we are hoping to continue to expand that. We're going into another round of the grant with the Wallace Foundation to continue that work. It is very, very important. The more work that is being done on leadership development in education, the more we are learning how important that is to creating successful environments for students and for teachers, and developing teacher leaders as well. But you're right, being a teacher today is incredibly challenging, and that's why for me this session is so important in terms of how we're talking about the levels of investment in our schools now, because now that we get to start reinvesting, we are going to be creating more successful environments for our teachers to remain in the profession and be more supported so they can create more success for our students.
Just to put this in additional context, if I may, visiting with teachers in my district would spend up to $1,200 of their own money to buy pencils and paper and supplies. I think that's it. Poor commentary, I guess, on how we're funding education. But if I might venture into the world of heresy just a bit, I'm going to go there. When does the sheer weight of regulations and its cost exceed the benefit? And how do we know when we've gotten to that point? And to me, that's a very fundamental question, as we see the federal government imposing greater and greater and greater demands, as we see this body and your department, you know, carrying out the policies that we put into place, putting greater and greater and greater demands on local districts, and as they then fall to the administration, they fall to the teachers. When does that weight of all of that just exceed any of the benefits? that any of us would hope for. And I know that's a rhetorical question, and it's in the world of heresy to even question these kinds of things, but I just get that sense that, you know, there's a tipping point at which things don't work well. And are we at that point?
Unfortunately, Representative Barner has the answer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I would talk about it in a slightly different way. I frankly, I don't believe that's heresy at all to ask that question. I think it's an essential question. And part of my frustration in looking at the regulatory system that we have is that many of the questions that are asked are the wrong questions. And you end up with data that may accurately answer those questions but mislead you into taking action that's the wrong action. I think that that is a good criticism of many of the requirements of No Child Left Behind. Generally a great idea, but the execution of it has been, the execution of it in terms of the kinds of questions that are actually asked and the kinds of data that this department is asked to produce, a lot of times is just wrong. We've already heard today from people who said very politely that they were wrong. I mean, they've said it very carefully, but they've said it. And I would say that the way to ask the question is, which regulations or which data gathered will actually clarify, improve, and streamline the process? Which data will help us provide a better education for our students? What data will help our teachers do a better job and do it under better working conditions? And if they do those things, then the answer is probably quite a lot. If they don't do those things, or if they are positively wrong in what they ask about and the answers they get and what you do as a result of those answers, then we should dump them, and it doesn't matter whether they're too many or not. Right? In that sense.
Senator Dubble.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I was going to say is that we're here as a Ways and Means Committee, and I think all these issues are very important issues. I think we've went to the system of accountability because of expectations that have been placed upon us, both by No Child Left Behind and by our own efforts. There are clearly some people that question some of those measures, but we are actually even doing more of this than what you're talking about. I mean, we're talking more and more in this building about performance measures on everything that we simply do. But some of those things are realities, too. There is a real achievement gap. That is an imaginary item. There is a real achievement gap. We do have relatively non-acceptable rates of high school graduation and non-acceptable rates of matriculation to higher education. But here we are as a budget committee trying to actually fund those items that by other statutes we are required to fund. I think we can debate policy in Senator Walker's committee, but this is a budget committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. I would agree, but I think the asking to invest what we're investing, you have to ask the fundamental question is sort of, what are you buying? So I think it's... I understand what you're saying, but I don't think there's a bright line.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when he said $25 million for... Did you say $25 million? Mm-hmm. And he said about half of that's federal money.
Like $11
million. The immediate question that went off in my head, why isn't more of it federal money? But,
yeah. All right, Mr. Costi, let's get to Joey.
Okay.
Sorry, we've taken a little detour. That was my bad.
Thank you, Chair Galizio. So I'm going to start out with the problem statement. The problem is that the retrieval and transfer of individual student records as a child moves through the system is very difficult. It's paper-based, and it takes a long time to move the data. That's the primary issue that we have here. Thanks to the KIDS pilot, we do have standards in place to make that happen, and we have a pilot to create create the electronic transcript to move those records between instances. So enter Joey. Joey's parents register him in the Oregon pre-K or kindergarten program. Joey comes in and he's assigned a student identifier. He is evaluated for program needs. Some of the programs Dr. Latini was talking about. If he needs any of those type of programs, if Joey has is English as a second language speaker, or anything like that, Joey is marked with that as part of his permanent student record. We make a note of it, and then Joey starts attending school, he starts receiving grades, and all of this information that has been logged at this point in time is entered into that district, that black dot there, my little red light, I don't think it's showing that far. Yeah, well, it's not working, but it's the little red circle, or the black circle on the right. That's the student information system where everything is captured. Next stage is, when Joey gets about to the third grade, he begins taking statewide assessments. And I just listed them there. I'm not going to go through each one of them because I've talked about them before. But what I do want to point out is that as those data are collected and put into reports, we can improve on the way those reports are created through the use of the growth model and the Kids in Assessment Literacy POP. So let me talk about the Assessment Literacy POP for a second. That's not necessarily reflected on that diagram. However, the way that teachers and administrators would get to that information is through the regional warehouse, the regional data warehouse that is in that. That information, along with Joy's student assessment information, is packaged in there. The policy option package for assessment literacy is to develop a curriculum, to come up with standardized content curriculum for all teachers and administrators to utilize. Not all teachers that Joey's going to experience in his lifetime in education are going to have the benefit of knowing about assessment, knowing about measurement data. If Joey's lucky, he's going to run into those rare teachers that actually have that training. What the assessment literacy proposal intends to do is provide training to every teacher in the state on an assessment literacy package and to connect with the university so that that's embedded in their curriculum, so that when our teachers leave our university systems, they know something about assessment literacy and measurement standards. The growth model POP, I talked a little bit about that on the introduction. What that does is allow schools and districts to get credit for showing extreme growth in, or adequate growth in certain areas as kids take their assessment. So let me explain that briefly. Currently, schools are measured based on the status of kids. They're, at this point in time, there's a 50% bar. 50% of the kids in any grade level, in any subject level, have to meet or exceed expectations. Doesn't matter if those kids are exceeding the trajectory of any other kid, that they've gained 2 to 3 years worth of knowledge in any 1 year. They have to pass the 50% mark. 50% of those kids have to exceed. What the growth model does is provide a different way of measuring success for schools. Meaning at some point in the time, if Joey didn't make standard, but he's on a trajectory to hit it at some point in time, the school should get credit for that improvement. With respect to the regional data warehouses, I talked about that earlier. There's about 6 ESDs in large school districts that are currently building these. Almost half of the students' data are currently housed in, or will be housed in, these 6 regional warehouses. These ESDs and districts have been working very closely with my project team on the Kids Initiative so that they develop the standards and they develop the connections so that as the regional warehouses become populated, we have made connections with the Kids Initiative so we can pull that data in through a process called extract, transfer, transform, and load. And it is a technical process, but what that means is the data are standardized and put into like kinds, so it's apples and apples, oranges and oranges, so that when they hit the kids' warehouse, everybody looks the same. It also allows for the exchange of student records as Joey moves across district lines and happens to move into a different district that doesn't have a regional warehouse. The pre-K-12 integrated data system will provide that capacity so that every kid in the state will have a regional warehouse that they will be part of. That teachers, the parents, and even the general public can have access to those data. You can also see on the diagram that the Kids Initiative actually it addresses the public accountability. We have public reports that are provided to our stakeholders. It also provides the federal and state accountability and provides the foundation for analysis, research, and information for policy makers. We also have another grant called the Cross-Office Data Management POP, Policy Option Package. That's internal to ODE. Joey wouldn't necessarily benefit from the cross-office data management policy option package directly. Indirectly, Joey would. What it would provide is additional research capacity for the department, and it trues up two of our FTE that have been set aside that we've been using as double fills currently. The Direct Access to Achievement grant, this is the Longitudinal Data Systems grant that you all approved last week. What that's intended to do is provide professional development and curriculum for all schools and districts throughout the state. It is going to be delivered through a regional approach through ESDs so that regionally, geographically, these training opportunities are available to all schools and districts. It's not coming directly from the ODE. It's moving through the regional education enterprise steering committee partners. The project will be sponsored by ODE, and the EESC that Dr. Latini talked about earlier is going to be the organization that pretty much runs that grant and manages that operation. What the grant will also do is provide additional research and analysis capacity for regions and for schools and districts so they can better use their data. It is really it's more than what assessment literacy is about, and I want to make that clear. Assessment literacy is specific to measurement and using measurement data, assessment data. This is about using all kinds of data and researching those data so that the teachers and researchers can look into the data and see where best practices might be for American Indian children, Native American children, or Hispanic children, or others. Where are they seeing huge growths in proficiency? And then finally, the Integrated Data Transfer System. This is the Oregon University System policy option package that we work tightly with community colleges and the Oregon University System. This ties it together. So when Joey goes to college, Joey doesn't have to go to his counselor anymore. He's going to be able to go to his counselor. His counselor won't have to drag out paper transcripts and get them stamped and certified and pulled out of archived and stored and maintained in vaults the way they currently are. They can come out of an electronic format, and the counselor will be able to move those data along with the student identifier that we have assigned in K-12 onto community colleges and the university system. What that does then is it allows us to truly link K-12 with the university systems and community colleges, so that when Johnny goes on to the university system at the end of his first year, we can get information back. Johnny's high school can get information back on how Johnny did. If Johnny got a 3.5 in high school and showed that he was exceeding in math, they can really verify that Johnny had exceeded in math and did hit those standards that they expected. This is going to tightly align the enterprise of education in Oregon. This is what's going to make it come together. I'm going to stop here.
I appreciate that. You're going to be back tomorrow?
I sure can be.
To answer a couple questions, maybe? I think it would be useful. Representative Edwards.
You want to wait until tomorrow to ask questions?
Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I was actually asking. I wasn't necessarily requesting.
I'll be back tomorrow.
Okay.
Can we just do that? Let's just
wait. It's 4:30. I appreciate it. Sorry about the long detour that we had, but I actually think it was somewhat
important for my sanity. So with that, we close the public hearing on House Bill 1519, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.